friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network USA, and we go now to Killow in County Longford. Killow, not far now, mind you, from where Áine Sheridan was bred and buttered, the home place. That was Balnalee, Clonbrony, Edgerstown, that area. On a fine day, you could cycle to Killow, and I would like to welcome John Connell, who is an author, a farmer, and perhaps one of the most celebrated new journalist writers in Ireland. If there's an award out there, more than likely John Connell has it already. But let me, first of all, welcome you, John, to the program.
Hello, Adrian, and hello to all your listeners. I hope that they're having a lovely Saturday in America. And greetings from Killow.
Well, thank you. And, of course, you're on your way over here. So, but I want to talk a little bit about your early years. And you grew up on a farm, but considering you're only 30-ish now, excuse me, and that you had spent, a decade as an immigrant, you weren't breaking your back as a teenager growing up with the farming, were you?
Well, I suppose I grew up on a small family farm, and farming was all we knew, and it was a way of life, and I suppose it was something that I really loved. Much has been made of the book that said, I never intended to return, but that wasn't the case.
Mm-hmm.
I'd always planned to come back, but life, as they say, got in the way, and being from an Irish family, there was always a great emphasis put on learning, and it was found that I suppose I was good with the pen, and my father, being a builder, encouraged me not to end up on the building sites.
Yeah.
So I ended up becoming a journalist, and the journalism brought me away from the farm for the best part of 10 years.
Yeah, and you slid over that one like fairly easily there. Journalism. You've had so much experience, everything from radio documentaries, and won several awards in Australia, and then got to work with ABC, National Broadcaster System, and before you knew it, you were not only working on journalism and in broadcasting, but you found yourself lecturing in college. Where was that, Australia?
That was in Sydney, in Australia. I suppose I'd been very lucky. I went to, they call Australia the lucky country. That's what the Australians call it themselves. And I went there as an exchange student. And they say you meet a couple of people who change your life.
Mm-hmm.
And there I met a woman who was the head of the journalism course. Her name was Wendy Bacon. She was the journalism professor. And she suggested to me about doing a documentary on the Aboriginal people in the desert. There'd been a big story happening there. And so I was up, and I lived in the desert for a time and made this program. And the program won an award, and that changed my life. And it was only about a year and a half later that I was lecturing at the same university that I had finished my studies in Sydney. And Australia had been a great place, and I suppose the Australians have this saying of the fair go, and that they, a little bit like Americans, that everybody can have a chance, and if you muck up, mm-hmm. you muck up, but we'll give you a chance. And I was given, I suppose, several chances, whether it was in journalism or documentary making, and to borrow an Irish phrase, I had a ochre sir up down, a hunger for the world, so mm-hmm. I wanted it, and I did.
When I came to America first at age 17. As an immigrant, I think maybe for the following decade or close to two, you know, I would meet people who were actually immigrants from Ireland, you know, who would say, do you think you'll ever go back? And it just annoyed the hell out of me, actually, because I didn't know. But I can relate to what you're saying in terms of leaving Ireland and having, you know, this yen to get back, hopefully with more to offer than when you were leaving. Did you, with the success that you were having as a journalist, was there any time that you said, you know, what the hell am I going back to Ireland for? You know, and particularly to a farm. Your father running the farm, you know, again, in the whole of his health, it's not like he was ready to pack it in. So there had to be, you had to have maybe some, you know, trepidation. Some part of you must have said, I hope if I do go back that it would be, you know, that it will be better than what I already have. Can you just relate to that?
Yeah, I mean, I totally can. I suppose, I think the greatest asset that Ireland offers its children is the glow of the place, the love of it. And in fact, that's what our government hopes when all the people left in the recession, yeah, that's what we'll bring them back, that it certainly wasn't the economic opportunity, but it was the people and the landscape. And, mm-hmm, you know, my wife is Australian and she has recently come to Ireland and she said to me, it's not the weather I'm here for and it's not the lifestyle, she said, but the people are some of the best people I've ever known. And I suppose at quiet times when I lived in Australia, though things were good, that sense of community wasn't there. And, you know, that can be atypical of any big city, mm-hmm, but I didn't feel a place for me there, even though I was having success. And when I came home, there was a place for me, whether it was as my father's son or as a member of the community. But being a journalist, being a writer, in Irish culture, there's a respect for that profession, because at times we need the men and women of words, when other words fail. And, I suppose I had a hope that, you know, I thought that I would come home maybe in my 40s after I'd made some money, but life brought me home a bit sooner than I intended. And what brought me home was mental health problems, Adrian, I suppose. That's the bare brass tacks of it. Mm-hmm. Life was going great and then it wasn't. And I ended up back on the farm, and certainly that was ground zero for a while, and I had to work to rebuild myself. But oddly enough, it was the thing that I had left as a child that I came back to, the farm, and it was the farm that brought me back to the good life. And it was a new sort of a life and a new way of being and a new way of understanding. But in working with the land, working with the animals, I suppose I saw my natural inheritance. And yeah, I suppose, to borrow a phrase from Patrick Kavanagh, I saw the beauty of the ordinary bounty before me, and it was something that I'd been missing for a long time, because you can have success but not be happy.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can be happy and not have success, and I certainly found that back on the farm.
Yeah.
I wasn't winning awards, but I was alive and I was happy again. And I owed that to the cows, and it was the cows that put me to college and the cows that brought me home.
Yeah. Now, your book is called The Farmer's Son, but in reading some of the reviews of your book, there are several references by fellow journalists that refer to it as the cow book, or the farmer's son. Tell us about the cow book. Was that an original? Was that supposed to be that was the title Yes,
well, the Cow Book was the title here in Ireland and England, and it was a joke title between me and our parish priest from Killow, and I initially was going to call it Virtue after the name of our farm, but after a lot of people had rejected it, I said to Rebecca, I'd call it the Cow Book as a joke, not thinking that anyone would buy it. But it's called The Farmer's Son in America because I suppose I am the farmer's son, and it's an easier title, and Americans are more straightforward people. So The Cow Book was a joke title, but The Farmer's Son is the title. It's the title that I like the best, actually. And I suppose it opens itself up then to the farming people of America, because there's certainly a lot of them, and I know that they're having difficult times too.
And that didn't start today or yesterday. Farming across America has always been, you know, a tough job. But many would say that it used to be a lot tougher, you know, before the advent of you know, farm machinery and you know, basic stuff like hand milking the cows. The milking machines that are now, even in medium-sized farms, takes away some of the labor-intensive customs of the day. Before you left, you say it was a small farm, and in fact, now what is a small farm in Longford, in Killow? What is that considered?
Well, I suppose a small farm would still be what it was many years ago. It'd be 30 acres. Ours is not 30 acres. It's a bit bigger than that. But it's a small farm by way of measuring farms in comparison to men from Meath, I suppose.
Or Mayo, I think. Yeah.
Or Mayo, very small compared to farms in America. I know farms in America could be, you know, thousands of acres. There's about 150 acres on the farm, you know, the way farming is in Ireland now, that couldn't keep a whole family going either. So we all have to have other jobs as well. We're beef farmers, and it's a tough industry, and particularly with Brexit, there's no certain future.
Yeah.
But you know, farming is what we know, and it's the ground stone on which we're built. And I suppose the book was a success in Ireland because, you know, there's about 100,000 farming families in the country, but there are also several thousand more people who are connected with the land in other ways, whether their relations live on the land or they have come from the land themselves. You don't have to dig very far in anyone's family tree to find a farmer. And that was something I didn't realize when I was writing the book. And it only occurred when the book went out into the world last year in Ireland, that people would write to me and tell me of their relationship with the land. And then when the book came out in Australia and New Zealand, the same thing happened. And it seems to be happening again in America already, even though the book isn't just out just yet. It's out on the 7th of May. The land is the thing that connects us all, and really, in the end, we're only just passing through it. So it's the beginning and end of all things.
Now, now you have decided to return to Ireland. Now, your wife, your relationship, was that a hard sell,
It was. I have a very good wife. I left Australia 4 years ago, and I said I'd be back in 3 weeks, and it took me, I said I'm going to try and write this book and not give up on the writing, and it took me 3 years for it to happen, and we had a long distance relationship between Ireland and Australia then, and I suppose if it wasn't for modern technology and phones and the internet, we wouldn't have stayed together, but we did, and last year Vivian moved to Ireland, and you know, we live in the countryside, and even though she works in Dublin, we enjoy a rural life, and she knows that's where we're going to be, and I suppose any man who's married would tell you that, but there's a great peace in knowing what's in front of you.
Yeah.
And it's been a positive experience for us. And we haven't killed each other yet, so I suppose it's going okay.
Yeah. Does she have an interest in farming?
No, she doesn't now. She is my wife is from a Vietnamese Australian family, and the famine is a long time ago in their past. But she likes seeing all the baby lambs and calves, so that's as far as it goes. But hopefully, in years to come, when the children arrive, they'll have an interest.
Now you return to all in all, what you were away for the bulk of 10 years, right?
I was, yes. Yeah. I lived in Australia and Canada.
Now, did you announce before you returned home that this was, as far as you could tell, a permanent move, or did the family think maybe you were coming home for a holiday with a big stack of saved up money from Australia?
I suppose they thought that I was coming home to work on a new book, and I suppose that I hadn't lived at home for a long time, so they didn't think that I'd be back. I didn't think that myself, but slowly, in returning to the land, I found the love of it again, and I realized that this was the place that I'd remain.
Yeah.
And it happened sooner than I thought, but also little things happened, little positive signs happened that made me think that I was doing the right thing. And, you know, having been an immigrant for so long, I had learned lots of things along the way,
mm-hmm.
but there was nothing quite like the contentment of home again. And that, I suppose, was the most positive thing, to find my place in the community again and feel connected. And
yes.
And not just through the land, but spiritually and with people. And the community in Longford welcomed me again, as Irish people do with people who return. We want everyone that leaves to come back. It's not possible for everyone to do that, but we do welcome those who come back.
Did you feel when you returned that you didn't have much to lose here anyway? First of all, you're an established journalist. You didn't give that up. You were coming back. You were going to write your novel. Was there a part of you that says, you know, if this doesn't work out, so I'll go back to Australia again. I'll go to Canada. I'll go somewhere, and I'll pursue my writing.
I suppose there was a part of me that thought that, but at the same time, I was an Irish person first, and I knew that I had to write an Irish book, and I think in coming back that I rediscovered all that, and as I say, you know, the slow dawning realization that this was home now, that was the positive thing, and I didn't think really about leaving again after that time. I went on holidays to different places, but when I did, I hankered to return, and I suppose those were the things that I knew that meant to make my roots in Ireland, and really that was a new journey for me, because I left at 19, and you know, I didn't know many people of my own age in Ireland, so I was an immigrant again in my own country, or an immigrant in my own country, getting to know people and building up a network, and there was a great joy in that too, because I saw Ireland with fresh eyes. When you grow up in a place, you can forget the beauty and the people that are in it, but when you come back, you're learning it all again. There's a new naming happening, and I suppose that was a joyous experience.
Since my day, growing up, late 40s through the 50s, and then I was here for the 60s, and from that day to this, was there a sense that if you did go back to Ireland, and you're probably way too young and things have changed so dramatically, but a great number of people in, you know, as, you know, in their, in, well, I won't talk about my age bracket, but even along the way would love perhaps to heed the call of Irish, successive Irish governments, but particularly the current government in Ireland, saying, come on back. You don't have to. We have plenty of work here. We have plenty of jobs here. And even when there were, when that was nothing other than a barefaced lie, there were people who, not unlike yourself, would say, God, I'd love to go back, but supposing I have to leave again because, you know, the grass was not as green when I was leaving, and, you know, the possibility of, you know, of failure, economic failure, failure within the family. You had a kind of an edge there that, you know, a lot of us didn't have, in that you were, a journalist, and so, again, and I'm doing the full circle here, I'm sure you've met many people who would have said to you, God, I'd love to do what you did, but, you know, I've nothing to fall back on if that doesn't work.
Yes, I mean, I did. I have friends who came back and had to leave again, I suppose when I came back, at first, Ireland was still in recession, so a lot of people had to leave. And in the time that I was away, there wasn't really a possibility to return at that time because the country was in recession, so there was no work. So I know on both ways what it was like, and certainly as a journalist, there certainly wasn't work in the media landscape in Ireland at the time either.
Mm.
So it was a tricky thing to encounter, but of course, that was nothing compared to the older generation that had went before us, because when you left then, that was it. And, you know, we are the lucky generation in that, you know, there always is a possibility of return, and your life might be a bit different when you come back, but we could come back. But, you know, the legions of people that went from the west of Ireland and the Midlands to America, you know, that wasn't a possibility for them. So I am aware of the privilege that my generation has, and the luck that we have.
I'm glad I didn't have to drag that out of you, you know.
No. America is the richer for the hundreds of thousands that left these shores, but we're also the poorer. And, you know, there are still, Ireland has never, you know, go back to the famine, but we never fully recovered from the loss of those people. And, you know, I was working on some writing the other day, and in the famine times in Ireland, there was 100,000 people lived in Longford, and there's only about 35,000 now. So there's 70-odd thousand people who left, 70,000 ghosts. And and those ghosts, many of them are alive, and they are the American people who, if it wasn't for them, you know, we wouldn't have had the peace process in Ireland, or we wouldn't certainly have had the economic boom, because I know that skills were brought back and money was sent back, and that kept the thing afloat. So my generation's experience is a far easier one, and I suppose we're walking on the shoulders of giants in that respect. And you know, the people who went before us, they were so brave, really. And,
I know,
went to a country that didn't know them and made a go of it.
That's
really the Irish story, that we, wherever we went, we made a go of it. But we didn't forget who we were in the process.
Yeah.
I suppose that's what made the Irish-Americans so great as a people.
The book is called The Farmer's Son. My guest is John Connell. And I was grinding my teeth there, and in farm language, chewing the cud, when I were listening to everything that you had said, which was absolutely not only correct, but it was a real, glowing account of say, the Irish contribution to America. But for, you know, the bulk of the time that I have been in America, never as bad as it is now, but the restrictions from Irish people who, you know, who in fact can rightly say as an ethnic group that we helped, we did more than our share to build America, and now to have the United States, because of stupid immigration laws, you know, taking Ireland lumped in with everybody else without any recognition, you know, for our Irish-American heritage, is sickening. But I just, as I say, if I didn't get that off my chest now, we wouldn't be able to continue to the part.
No, it's important, and you know, I mean, I know well the city. The reason I wasn't an immigrant in America is because an Irish person can't legally move there. You know, it wasn't an option, and you know, America would have been the place I wanted to go, and but it's not possible, and there, you know, when I think of all the people that left in my generation, and many of them haven't returned. None of them got to go to America, and certainly America's the poorer because of that, because there was a lot of skills that could have been brought, and you know, successive governments haven't worked on that on both sides, and then we have the case of the undocumented Irish, particularly on the East Coast in America, and that makes things you know, very difficult, because people who are living the American life and contributing to the society can't ever leave America and visit their families. So it's a very tricky situation, and I suppose hopefully that I know Nancy Pelosi was over the Good Friday 20-year anniversary, sure the Democrats who have a strong affinity. I don't want to be talking about another man's country politics, but I know the Democrats certainly have a good relationship with the Irish. So hopefully something could be done there, because certainly the Trump administration is anti-immigration for everyone. It's not just Irish.
Well, now that you've alienated half my audience there, Tom Connell. Thanks. I needed that, actually. You said a lot of stuff that, you know, that I can't say over and over again every week, because I, you know, if people shut me up, then I'm not going to hear that.
There have been great Republican leaders with Irish roots, and of course Ronald Reagan, I know. So you know, and the Republican Party, as everyone knows, is the party that ended a lot of things in America, including slavery. So there's a great hereditary link there. Yeah. I just think that America is faced with a lot of difficult issues at the time, and I suppose we all want the best for America, because it is the country that everyone looks up to, whatever side of the house you're on.
I think, though, and you've more than touched on it, the best for America would be, you know, to at least acknowledge that those who built America should have, you know, an opportunity to continue the tradition. We don't have anything to prove beyond what we've already done. But I want to bring this back, because we're going to be chatting for the next hour on that one. But I want to bring you back to, now you've arrived at home, your father has no, it's not like, and you had mentioned that he was a builder, but number one, he was a farmer, and he himself being a farmer's son, what, when you went in with the, with your notebook, with your notepad and your writing pad and the pencil behind the ear, how quickly did you get involved in becoming, you know, a significant contributor to the farming, and what kind of work did that entail?
Well, I suppose whenever I would go home from even when I was an immigrant, I would work on the farm and help out, and it was kind of an immediate thing. I had come home to to work on a book on JFK, actually. And I was farming. The book didn't ever come out, but I was farming at the time as well. And we have a beef and sheep farm. So it was working with the cattle, but in particular the sheep. We had recently, when I came home, we had only got into sheep, and it was a new thing for my father, and I had found that I had a knack at it. So I was working a lot with the sheep and the lambing. And, you know, it was a funny thing, because the farmer's son was never really intended to as a book. It was a suggestion from my agent at the time, and I resisted, and I thought, well, sure, who'd be interested in me writing a book about farming? But it turned out to be something more special and more intimate, and really it was the old adage of write what you know. And
yeah.
And despite having been an immigrant for so long, what I knew was farming, and that's what I'd been brought up with. And so that book that came out of it was as close as I could be to writing about me.
You're hardly into the book before you give an amazing description of a challenge, one that you had no experience in, at least on your own, in the calving season. You seem to have landed right in the calving season at home. And how much did you know? Had you been an observer? Had you been had you served your time in helping to deliver calves before you left? Or tell us about that part.
Yes, I had. I suppose the book starts with a bang, in that it's about me delivering a calf for the first time by myself. I'd done it for many years as a child, helping out, but I had never, I suppose, been allowed to do it on my own. And in a way, that was a sort of a passing of the baton, in a sense. And there was no one there that night. The cow was calving, and I took the calf myself. But it was a little moment where I suppose my family knew that the boy's done good, and that, you know, there will be someone to take over here. And I suppose that is the concern in every family, that there'll be someone, daughter, whether it be daughter or son, to take over. And I suppose it was a way for them to know that things were okay. And of course, the birth of the calf was also the birth of the book. And it was from there that I wrote that first chapter shortly after I delivered the calf. And I thought, there's something here in this. And certainly now I've calved many, many calves, and the experience is still a lovely one, but it's not as newfangled to me anymore. But it is something that I suppose I see still a great joy in, and it makes you feel very connected to the world around you.
As you have pointed out, Ireland is a fabulous place, it is a friendly place, and for many who visit Ireland, 10 million plus last year alone from every part of the world, we pass farms, and we see cows, we see cattle, we see horses, sheep, and we mistakenly think that, well, that must be a lot of work, because after all, they have to be milked in the morning and milked in the evening, and that does not even scratch the surface as we drive by and say, you know, they're not that much trouble. And, you know, particularly the dry stock, again, cattle that don't have to be milked, they're out there and the day will come and they'll be worth a fortune. But talk, if you will, if you had to list some of the chores of a farmer and farm life, other than the milking, that it's easier for us to see that everything is just so lovely, and now with milking machines, what the hell, that can't be all that tough. Give us a little bit of flavor, as you have in your book, and my God, it's so fabulous and descriptive. But what are the other things? What did you find other than the challenge and the success of being able to say to deliver that cast on your own? What are some of the other less glorious experiences?
Well, I suppose the farm is divided into two sides of the year, one being winter, which is a very busy time. There's the calving, but also the fattening of the dry stock that we're going to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And one enters the routine. And the routine is, I suppose, for some it's mind-numbing, and for others it's part of the job. But we would continually be scraping down animals, cleaning them.
Mm-hmm.
There's certainly a lot of manure, and that has to be removed and animals bedded. And then the lambing comes along, and there's a lot of sheep to be born. And, of course, then after that we would have dosing and administering of medicines.
Mm.
And then when the spring comes, which we're in now, the animals are released and put into the fields. And for the sheep, we have to watch for foxes and stray dogs that might take the lambs. And we certainly have had problems with foxes in previous years. And then we must watch the cows for various ailments that they could get, black leg or red water, which is born from a tick and can kill them very quickly. And so always there's a lot of watching. And in the summer, then we enter the hay and silage making season. And I suppose this is a lovely time on a farm. Even though it's a lot of work to make the hay and silage, we joy in the work. And a man could work till 11 o'clock at night at it, or 12, and eat his dinner at midnight. But the weather is good, or usually hopefully good, and we take joy in it. And I know last summer I spent the summer fencing the land and putting up the barbed wire, and that was hard work. But at the same time, it's a little bit like a book. You could look at it each day and say, well, I fenced that field, and like writing a book, you say, well, I've wrote that chapter. And there's a great sense of accomplishment in farm work, because everything you do, there's a positive that can come out of it. Now, of course, there are negative things that happen too. Animals will die, and any farmer that will tell you he doesn't feel sad or sore after something dies wouldn't be telling you the truth, because we feel every blow. And farming in Ireland, like many farms in America, it's family farming, and you know every animal does count. And so you take great care in the animals, because it's the walk with survival for all of you. And they're taking care of you, and you're taking care of them.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's ritual and routine in it. And I suppose the rhythm of a farm life. And many people listening to you this morning might have left that rhythm. But in reading the book, I suppose they can understand what our rhythm is, and what their ancestors' rhythm was.
Your book is a series of, you know, of short stories. And for anybody, even those who weren't brought up in a farm, I think you get that, you get the flavor, which, you know, probably wouldn't have, that story wouldn't have been a huge seller, you know, 50 years ago or previous to that. But I think that there are a couple of things. And perhaps you can tell us about the government regulation. God knows in my day, there wasn't anybody watching the stock or telling you what to do, or, you know, it was considered that each farmer, in the absence, of course, of all the, all of the chemicals that have come into use since then, that cows and that cattle and animals would be healthy if they were cared for. But it now seems, particularly say with milk and the produce of milk, that there are a ton of regulations that maybe some farmers might feel are over the top. What would you say?
Well, I suppose you see, you're going into agribusiness there, and there is food standards that have to be met, and certainly any farmer will tell you there's a lot of paperwork these days, and that's how it is. But that is how it is, and if you want to be in the business, you have to deal with the paperwork. And you know, a neighbour of ours who's a woman farmer and a very good one, always says, you know, you have to farm the paperwork too. You have to work the paper, and you know, I suppose the world wants to know where food comes from, and being in the developed world, we have to. There are certain standards, and if you don't meet them, you won't be able to sell your product, and that's as simple as it is. You know, the paperwork can be difficult, but at the same time, it does mean that for the consumer at the end of the line, and really that is, you know, farming, I can say it's a lovely thing, but at the end of the day, we're trying to make a buck like everyone else.
Right.
The consumer can be very happy in what they buy. And, you know, I was in America last year in Los Angeles, and I walked into a supermarket and I had a great swell of pride when I saw the Kerrygold butter.
Absolutely.
Now, the Kerrygold butter was very expensive, but it was expensive because it was a number one A1 class product. And I suppose there was a great pride in that because the animals had been farmed properly, they had proper nurturing, and the milk was the best it could be, you know. And if you want to sell good food, that's the game now. You're going to have to do all these things. But it does mean that Irish farming stands above many other countries, particularly Britain. You know, our farmers, we would better farmers. And Ireland is an agricultural country.
Yeah.
So we have to make sure that the land mass isn't getting any bigger. So we have to make sure that we farm it wisely.
Right. And you know, again, it's not an exaggerated figure of 10 million visitors to Ireland last year. When they are surveyed, it is a new day when perhaps, you know, very high up on the measuring scale after, you know, the great Falsha, that welcome that you have in Ireland, the tremendous work done by Tourism Ireland and the Falsha that is there. Very high on the list that word spreads throughout the world. It's food, Irish food, food throughout Ireland, in every possible category. There is, say, even, I'm sure, in each of the counties, there is a certain pride in restaurants and in food that is grown locally, that is produced right there, so that you're not, despite the European Union and all that goes along with that, the food has again become a great, great tribute in Ireland, and a far cry from you know, the old days when eyes would roll and say, "How is the food?" Oh, geez. It's come a long way.
It has. I mean, I suppose America started the whole foodie trend, but we're reaping the rewards of it now a few years after our American cousins. But people are very interested in what they're eating, and they're also very interested in local. And you know, you might hear the phrase carbon footprint, but they want to eat local and know that the food has been produced locally. And it's a circle that benefits everyone, because your tourists, say, coming from America and coming to Kerry or Mayo or Longford, they want to eat something and drink something at the local places. And, you know, it's led to all the microbreweries and microdistilleries springing up across the country to provide people with a local brew, something which Americans do very wonderfully themselves as well. And then from that came, you know, milk and cheese and meats and nice vegetables. And I suppose we have the recession, in a way, to thank for that, because Ireland had to slow down and assess where it was and who it was, and we kind of had forgotten who we were in those boom years. And the recession made us think, what is it that makes us Irish? And it is the Cade Mhíle Fáilte, the 100,000 workers, but it's also our food and hospitality. And Through a couple of difficult years in the recession, we emerged with a great and burgeoning food culture. And, you know, I do always pride myself on that when I have visitors come over from overseas. I live in Killow and I go to a local butcher, and I would get a rack lamb from Sean, and I'd say, well, where did that lamb come from? And he'd say, it came from the field across the road. You know, there's zero food miles on that, and it's the best lamb you could eat. And, you know, those are the simple joys in life. And, Irish food is wonderful. It's as nice as American food, but I suppose it's a small country, so you actually can see the goods that your dollars are being spent on, and you're keeping local people alive in areas where there isn't any other economic opportunity. You know, rural Ireland doesn't have big factories, but our factories are our fields, and it's there that we're making our livelihood.
You would be launching the book here on the 9th of May, and that launch will take place at the American Irish Historical Society. The book, The Farmer's Son, by John Connell. And John, as our guest, I would love to say I intentionally left out some of the very probably touchy parts, the relationship, say, with you, your father, the lifestyle that you have chosen. That's part of the book, that's part of the story. But would you tell us, in the sense that what you write about is so extremely graphic, do you feel that a lot of sons, including those who never left Ireland, would in fact have, part of the transition might be very difficult, the relationship with, the father, the historic values of how to farm, the continuation of traditions, and that, you know, some young buck coming in here now, wanting to change things. Is that reluctance? That wouldn't be just with you and your father. Would you have friends, people who would say, yeah, that's it, we don't talk about it?
Yes, I suppose, Adrian, in the year that the book has been out, I've got many, many, many letters from different people from different walks of life, farming and not farming, and they've said to me that that's their relationship with their father too, and that there was pressure. Maybe he had an accountancy business or a carpentry business, sure. and the father wanted to pass the business to the son or daughter. And I suppose the young generation come in with their own ideas, and we think we know better, and we're flying in the face of decades of experience. And I suppose the answer to that I have is that that's human nature and human life, and every family, there's never been a family made that didn't have any sort of conflict in it, but conflict is what makes us who we are and makes us better people. And I suppose there was a universality, the reason the book has been a big success is there's a universality in it, and, you know, my father and I, at times we were like two bulls in a field, and, you know, two bulls will fight, but eventually the two bulls will come to peace, and then we have come to peace, and the success of the book has allowed that, and I suppose it allowed my parents to understand that a man could make a living from his pen as well as working with a shovel and spade.
And in fairness, John, you do say, that what you learned, you learned from your father, you learned from that tradition that has been in your family. It's not, you're not coming in like, you know, a bulldozer. That actually farming, granted, may be different, and updated methods to deal with it. But at the end of the day, it's not like you're in getting up in the morning intentionally trying to indoctrinate those who came before you. Of course, in every house you're going to have some discord about something. But versus the day that you arrived home to again, you know, to pursue the family business, the farming, and today, are there a lot of unresolved problems that will never, be, resolved? How would you call the relationship now versus the growing pains that happened when you return?
Look, I call the relationship very good. I mean, as I said, you know, my parents have seen the success of the book, and it's allowed them, first of all, any parent wants their child to be happy. And I had come home unhappy because my health wasn't well, and they see now that I'm happy and that I have a career that's paying the bills. And I suppose everything else is a bonus in life. If you have your health, you have it all. And family is thick, and we're there for each other in the big stuff. And, you know, you forget about the small stuff when the big stuff comes along. And certainly I underwent a transformation. And, you know, it's the job of the young to be radical and the old to be more mature. And I think as we mature ourselves, we become less radical, and it's all for the better. So I can say that I've certainly grown up in those 2 years, and it's made me a better person.
Thank you for your time. And again, the launch will be at the American Irish Historical Society May 9th. And it's going to be at 6:30 in the evening. And the American Irish Historical Society, 991 Fifth Avenue at 80th Street in New York. And you can go to the Society's Facebook to reserve your space. We do know that a great number of Longford people from, say, the Longford Association, the Longford GAA. Boy, you're a clannish click when I come to think of it. But anyway, we'll have to...
Yeah, and I should add that Paul Muldoon, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, and is a northern poet, is going to officially launch it. And,
that...
Yes, and that the Irish Consulate of New York has kindly helped with everything. So none of this would be possible without them and the American Irish Historical Society. So I'm very thankful to the Irish community in New York, because none of this would be possible without them. And, you know, it's making a long-term dream of having a book launch in America come true. So I'm very proud to be Irish at this moment.
Well... And we're proud as well. And also, you won't be hanging around the American Irish Historical Society, because you're working on a project for the New York Times as well. And if I wasn't supposed to divulge that, you can ignore the question and I'll go back to.
I'm working on a piece for them in relation to the book, so hopefully it'll. The piece has been sent. It's about Brexit and farming in Ireland. So people can look out for that. Hopefully it'll be coming out around the time of the book launch. So very much looking forward to getting to America and seeing all the cousins and relations. And and we might go for an old tipple afterwards. So if people come along, stay. Stay. It'll be a late night.
Okay. Listen, good luck to you. And I find, anyway, when I am in Longford and around your neck of the woods there in Edgeworthstown, is that my great fear is that because of the density of the Sheridan family, I could trip on top of one of them any day of the week. So, but I'm sure that that's that could relate to, of course, a lot of rural areas in Ireland, where a great number of people who are brought up or bred and buttered in the land. And I would like to go back, oh my God, how many decades ago, when we had a bishop of a canary who would come around to administer the sacrament of confirmation. And part of his lecture or his homily would be to all of us. He would point out the evils of immigration and the wickedness of the world out there. And he would say with great sincerity, that is why I ask you children of Ahimas, stick to the soil, stick to the soil. Great.
Thank you. Thank you, AJ.
All right. God bless. Okay, and friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, our guest, John Connell. Again, much acclaimed and has such too many endorsements to even get into, but positive reviews, Irish Times, Sunday Times, Roddy Doyle, Colm Tobin, you name it. He is boy wonder of Ireland. And you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. The family show live from New York. We'll be right back.